Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. My guest today is Tulane University historian Lawrence Powell, author of The Accidental City, Improvising New Orleans. And we'll talk with garden designer and preservationist Susan Haltom, whose new book is One Writer's Garden, Eudora Welty's Home Place. If there were a Yellow Pages listing for historians in the New Orleans phone book, Larry Powell would be at the top of the list. He holds the James H. Clark Endowed Chair in American Civilization and is director of the New Orleans Center for the Gulf South at Tulane University. He's a prize-winning historian who also contributes his considerable energies to a number of civic endeavors, including the Louisiana State Museum, as well as Friends of New Orleans Cemeteries, to name only a few. He's written many books, most notably Troubled Memory, Anne Levy, The Holocaust, and David Duke's Louisiana. And he's here to talk about his new book, The Accidental City, Improvising New Orleans. Hi, Larry.
Hi, Susan.
Welcome to The Reading Life.
Thanks very much for having me.
You've written about so many aspects of New Orleans history, and many in the more recent past. So what was it that drew you back to the very beginning?
Well, I had to begin at the beginning, and as soon as I began there, I realized how little I knew. And there's been such a outpouring of new literature, both popular and scholarly, that I felt I really couldn't proceed further with the story until I don't want to say mastered that period, but at least established some comfortable familiarity with it.
Now, we have been in kind of a boom time in colonial history, haven't we?
And that was part of the problem. I mean, I dive in and I thought it would be a small pond. It's this roiling ocean. So fortunately, I came up for air. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of the story of my life. I take on these projects before asking myself if I have a parachute on and jump out of the plane, yell Geronimo, and say, well, wait a minute.
It's a long way.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things I really wanted to ask you was that when we first talked about this book, when you were first thinking about a title, you called it The Making of an American Pompeii. That was your original subtitle. What was your thinking that led to improvisation?
Well, I guess it grew out of my sense that we've always managed to improvise something out of catastrophe, and the whole history, I think, is punctuated by catastrophes, real and imagined. Mm-hmm. And the place was really planted on the precipice of a potential disaster waiting to happen. But that original title was written or conceived in a moment of pessimism.
Right.
3 or 4 weeks after Katrina. And I, quite frankly, I thought it was 50-50 whether we would ever come back. And then as I saw us come back, I said, gee, how come I underestimated the cultural resilience of this place?
Right.
You know, sort of been there, done that.
Mm-hmm.
And so my own view of the history evolved as I began not only to write about it and understand that earlier, very precarious period and very creative and inventive period somewhat better, but as I saw the life of this place return and the things that caused it to return, including a deep sense of attachment, but all those other simple pleasures that, you know, it's not only a place where survival is possible, but somehow we figure out how to make it worthwhile.
No matter what.
No matter what.
So many well-known figures stride across these pages. Bienville, Iberville, John Law, the Sun King, Andrew Jackson. In so many familiar incarnations and situations, the list just goes on and on. But what did you find about these characters that kept you writing about them and kept you engaged?
I saw them as real human beings instead of kind of plaster saints, as Bienville and Iberville are often treated. I mean, Bienville and Iberville both, I think, had kind of a roguish character as large as their ambitions. And I found that fascinating. I found it fascinating the way Bienville defied his bosses back in France and his board here on the Gulf Coast and built a city where he was told not to.
They especially came alive for me, those two. We may have become an improvisational city, but one of the things you wrote that struck me the most was that at the very beginning, New Orleans was one of the most planned cities in North America.
Yeah, you know who I got that insight from, to give credit where credit's due, is Shannon Doughty, who wrote a wonderful book called Building the Devil's Empire. I read it in dissertation, then reread it as a book. And it struck me as just a wonderful metaphor for ambitions and designs gone awry. And, you know, that too is part of our story, that we begin with some over-the-top, outsized prospects and projects, and somehow we managed to shrivel them down to size. And that's where that came from. I was using that really as a way to underscore the improvisation. And Shannon, to her credit, also plays on that theme. And I just kind of run with it more, because I have a larger time span to run with it.
But I loved that. In the very beginning, literally, there were more urban planners here than at any other time, even after Katrina.
Yeah, I think if you counted them per capita, that's probably the case.
I love that. I thought that was a wonderful detail. Now, the other thing that I was fascinated by was the evolution, that improvisational evolution, and the many types of city we have been in the past. And I wonder if you'd go over a few of those.
Well, we became, you know, as a French colonial city and an African market town.
That's the part I really loved. I thought that was so alive.
Yeah. I mean, this was much an African town as it was a French or a Spanish town. I mean, the Spanish features, of course, were in the architecture, but I think they had a big hand in the setting the parameters by which the free people of color basically invented themselves. But it's gone through several iterations, and it became, you know, a crossroads of commerce for the Atlantic world, the Caribbean world, the frontier. It was a smuggler's paradise. You can see where we've developed that attitude toward laws here, that they're to be evaded, not obeyed. And I'm convinced it was braided into our DNA right from the beginning. It was part of a survival instinct that's in Lamarckian fashions become really who we are.
Right. So many of the things you touch on have been hot button issues throughout our entire history. Creole culture, the idea of the free people of color, the code noir, but the whole notion of adaptability is what gets us onward, moves us forward, isn't it?
It is. It's a way in which we adapt not just to environmental and hazards, God knows there's been a lot of them, but to the attempts of outsiders or newcomers to kind of impose their will on us. And we've always been able to, in the end, assimilate them rather than to bend ourselves into their, according to their wishes.
And yet you have these wonderful wry insights about how, you know, disasters in our history could often have been foreseen. And yet we don't go for the preventable measure. We don't find that magic fix ahead of time. We have to improvise it after the fact.
Well, I think in many ways we are a sensate culture, an enjoyment culture, and it's been part of it. We don't always learn the right lessons from history, but we kind of make our own according to.
Well, the other thing that struck me was one of the things you mentioned was the suddenness with which New Orleans became a slave culture, a center of slavery.
Yes.
And I hadn't really thought about that before.
Well, I hadn't either until I put it in comparative perspective, because at least in North America, it's probably true in a lot of slave cultures that they begin gradually and then mature suddenly into a full-blown slave society. Because of John Law's ambitions to create a Chesapeake on the Mississippi, they poured a lot of slaves and settlers in here. And almost overnight, it became a plantation society. But then it didn't work. There was a Natchez massacre, and John Law's company went belly up. They pulled back. And so these planters had all these slaves on their hands without much for them to do, because there was really not much of a market for the things that were growing, like indigo or tobacco. They weren't even growing that much. And so, in a sense, we went backwards. We became a slave society that became just a society that had slaves, and the slaves were often fending for themselves, and everybody was trying to figure out how to survive.
And that's so interesting, because that's not the kind of change I think of as sudden, but so many of the others were as well, when you start to think about the fires. you know, the floods, the storms. Oh, yeah. We have had a lot of sudden change.
Yeah, we have. There are periods of slow evolution, then all of a sudden there's this lumpy change. You know?
This convulsion.
Yeah, right. And you lurch forward like an earthquake or like, you know.
So your own feelings about the city underwent a kind of evolution as you were writing this book.
Oh, really? Yeah. And it helped clarify a lot of things I thought about the city and made me realize that, you know, basically I'm a New Orleanian now. I mean, I can put up with things that I think a lot of people can who never lived here before.
Well, you talk about it as that wonderful place of reinvented identity. And people come here and become themselves.
Yeah. It's sort of a metaphor for carnival, too, that you put on a mask in order to take one off. And I think the whole city, in some sense, makes that possible for people who are trying to escape whatever they're trying to escape from or to become something different.
We all conspire and improvise together in our own ways. It's been a pleasure. Professor Lawrence Powell is the author of The Accidental City, Improvising New Orleans. You can meet him April 5th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Thanks, Larry.
Thanks, Susan.
Spring is a time for new beginnings in life and in the garden. If you're seeking inspiration, you need look no further than One Writer's Garden, Eudora Welty's home place, written by Susan Haltom and Jane Roy Brown, with photographs by Langdon Clay. Since 1994, garden designer Susan Haltom has overseen the restoration and preservation of a very special garden belonging to Eudora Welty in Jackson, Mississippi. Welty's home is a literary museum now, a place of pilgrimage, where visitors admire the beautiful garden that Welty and her mother Chestina shared. Susan Haltom has made that garden a glorious place. Welcome to The Reading Life, Susan.
Oh, hey, Susan. Other Susan, thanks so much for having me today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to talk with you about One Writer's Garden, which has been such a labor of love. You first met Eudora Welty in 1994, right? And the garden was in very sad shape.
That's right. She'd lost her yard man of over 40 years. She was in her middle 80s. She was living alone, had stress fractures of her back, and could no longer get outside and work in the garden. And I was invited by the Mississippi Department of Archives and History, for whom I worked at the time, and to whom she had deeded her home, was invited by them to go to visit her. And in her living room, she looked at me and said, "I can't bear to look outside and see what has become of my mother's garden." And it really moved me, and I felt like I needed to help, but I didn't know how. Because this was not a state property yet, we were very careful how we proceeded, and I got a local attorney who was volunteering at the local stew pot or soup kitchen, and he got two homeless men to help. So the four of us, for about 4 months, pulled weeds, pulled poison ivy, pulled honeysuckle, and just got it to where she knew that there was something happening. And then after that, for months and months, I just watched to see what would come up, and I would do a little bit of planting. At night, I would go back and read her short stories, which I hadn't read for about 30 years. And they really mean a lot more to you as a mature woman. I noticed also that the plants that I would see in the garden in the daytime were also plants that she'd written about and included as background for her prose. So I would get to go inside and visit with her, too, after our work in the garden, and she would start remembering and telling stories about the garden.
I loved it because she said she wanted to do something, and those memories were what she could do at that time.
That's absolutely right. And you may remember that memory was the thing that she valued more than anything. I have a lovely, lovely quote that she included in her autobiography, One Writer's Beginnings. She said, "The greatest confluence of all is that which makes up the human memory, the individual human memory. My own is the treasure most dearly regarded by me in my life and my work as a writer. And she continued, time also is subject to confluence. Confluence is the word that she was speaking about at the time. And she said, the memory is a living thing. It too is in transit, but during its moment, all that is remembered joins and lives, the old and the young, the past and the present, the living and the dead. And so I imagine as she remembered her garden that she worked in side by side with her mama, that she remembered all those personalities to whom she wrote, the farm women, her friends, her agent in New York City, her friend Elizabeth Lawrence, the garden writer in North Carolina. All the people came alive to her in her memories about the garden, and that's what we wrote about in our book.
Tell us about the preservation efforts right now. The garden is done, isn't it?
No, a garden is never finished.
I know that.
Garden is preserved in time. So, as you know, the canopy is always changing. And although this garden in 1925, when it was laid out by her mama, was established underneath a pine wood. Eventually, those pine trees mostly were struck by lightning or left, and then the hardwoods grew in and knit together. And so then it shaded out the perennial border and the roses and so on. The story of how those were discovered and how they came back or how I have found them is told in the last chapter of our book, really the epilogue.
Now, one of the things I especially love about this beautiful book is the way Eudora Welty's garden branches out into and mirrors so much of American garden history, that it was, for Chestina, as it was for many American women of that time, the garden was an outlet for their artistic impulse. And then you chronicle the rise of garden clubs, which were also so important to Chestina, and these social customs, that wonderful thing of, you know, having a guest, and when they leave, having them pick a bouquet to take with them.
Oh, yes. This is a time period when not only garden clubs, but woman's clubs, they called them at the time, gave women an outlet to change society. When they were so popular in the 19-teens and 20s, these women, many of them didn't get to go to college, but they were able to meet and discuss and interpret and exchange. It was just a wonderful outlet, as you said, for them. And I believe that because Chestina saw the garden as a learning experience, and because she had been a school teacher, that she was able to encourage her daughter Eudora to be the person she was meant to be. And we all, in this day and time, don't really know what our foremothers did, but Jane and I tried to explain that in our book, and I am just so excited to learn more about all these interesting women.
Now, another thing that's really enchanting about the book are the photographs. Langdon Clay's contemporary photographs are so vivid and lovely, but there are so many vintage photographs of Eudora and Chestina in the garden.
Oh, thank you so much. We wanted to give as much of the story as possible. So it's really a book that I hope will appeal to a broad audience. We intended it to be beautiful, and Langdon made it that way. University Press of Mississippi, I think, did a fabulous job putting it together because it is quite large and pretty dense. And we tried very hard to make it affordable so that other people could share in this interesting story.
Well, I can't wait to come to you in Jackson and see this garden.
I need to tell you something. Eudora said to me, don't make this garden something it wasn't.
Oh.
And it's a 3/4 acre garden, and it's a home garden. So when you see the book, it encapsulates all the seasons of the garden and all the years. So when you go to visit it, it's supposed to look like Eudora just stepped out, and you might not see the overwhelming fluorescence that you expect to see, but it does represent the way that garden looked. And my period of significance there is 1925 to 45. So everything is supposed to be accurate, and we try to establish, as Eudora did, a chink-proof world of appearance in her prose and her fiction. we tried to have an accurate representation of the way the garden looked then. But do come and visit.
Well, seeing the world through her eyes is always a gift, as you know. We've been talking with Susan Haltom, who's one of the authors of the wonderful book, One Writer's Garden, Eudora Welty's Home Place. She'll be talking about that book at the Past Christian Historical Society Wednesday, April 11th, and in Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street, Thursday, April 12th at 6 o'clock. Susan, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Delia Tomino Nakayama teaches American Haiku workshops every Monday in April, 2 to 4 p.m. at Sekisui Restaurant, 239 Decatur Street. For registration and information, call 504-289-9142. Today's guest, Larry Powell, signs The Accidental City, Improvising New Orleans, Thursday, April 5th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Pamela Davis Nolan discusses and signs Coffee Colored Dreams, Thursday, April 5th at 6 p.m. at Maple Street Bookshop in the New Orleans Healing Center. 17 Poets Literary and Performance Series presents beat poet Ruth Weiss, reading from and signing her recently reprinted Desert Journal, Thursday, April 5th at 8 p.m. at the Goldmine Saloon. Robert Gianfro discusses and signs The Story Behind the Stone, Saturday, April 7th at 3 p.m. at Maple Street Bookshop in the New Orleans Healing Center. And the poet Sulla reads from new work, followed by an open mic Sunday, April 8th at 3 p.m. at the Maple Leaf Bar. Novelist Robert Olmsted reads from and signs The Coldest Night, Monday, April 9th at 5:30 at the Garden District Bookshop. Celebrate National Poetry Month with Lee Mites and Grew, reading from Downtown, and Ni Osundari, reading from City Without People, Monday, April 9th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Suzanne Johnson signs her urban fantasy novel, Royal Street, Tuesday, April 10th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Alexandra Styron discusses her memoir, Reading My Father, Tuesday, April 10th at 6 p.m. at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. And Michael Lee reads from Something in My Eye, Tuesday, April 10th at 7 p.m. at the Columns Hotel as part of the 1718 Reading Series. Major support for The Reading Life is provided by Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org or email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org. Thanks for listening and keep reading.